to fuck with guys like you.
I will ask the question again. Syed stayed steady. What is your real name?
Ulysses S. Grant.
You are lying?
Of course, you fucking idiot! Don't you read history?
Syed moved in for the second fingernail. He wedged the pliers under the nail bed, wiggled it again to make sure he had a good enough grip, and then looked into Hurley's eyes. He didn't like what he saw. It was the wild-eyed look of a crazy man.
Do it! Come on!
Hurley egged him on.
What are you waiting for? You're not turning into a pussy on me, are you?
Part of Syed knew he should stop and come back later when he could control the situation. The men were here, however, so he needed to pull this second nail and then let this lunatic sit and stew for a while. Probably come back and use electricity. He tightened his grip and yanked the second nail free. Hurley howled again with the laughter of a madman. The shrieking turned to cackles and then uncontrollable laughter. His eyes were filled with tears as he yelled,
18 more to go! Yee-haw!
Syed dropped the pliers on the cart. That's right. We'll give you a little rest before we start with the others. He started for the door. Hurley looked at the other man who was standing in front of him.
Is that you, Abu? Abu Radi? I haven't seen you in years. I heard you have your own little terrorist group now. Fatah, look at you, all grown up,
Hurley said admiringly. Radi smiled and shook his head. He clearly thought the American insane. Hurley tilted his head to the side, as if trying to recall some distant memory.
I bet you weren't more than 4 feet tall when I used to fuck your mother. Did you tell your friends that she was a prostitute?
Hurley craned his head to look at the other two men.
His mom could suck cock better than any whore I ever met, and trust me, I've been with a lot of whores.
The smile left Roddy's face in an instant. He lashed out with his right fist, hitting Hurley in the mouth. Hurley's head rocked back from the blow, and then, before Roddy could throw another punch, Syed grabbed him from behind.
No,
Syed ordered. Do not let him get to you. Hurley shook the sting and fog from his head and came up smiling. One of his top metal teeth had been knocked out, and his mouth was filling with blood.
Look!
Hurley yelled, showing them the gap in his top row.
Look, you knocked my tooth out!
Roddy and Syed stopped struggling for a second, and that was when Hurley unleashed a gob of blood and the one busted tooth from his mouth. The bulk of it hit Roddy in the face. With his arms tied behind his back and his legs taped to the chair, Hurley started bouncing the chair an inch at a time toward the two men, snapping his teeth and barking like a dog. Chapter 51. Moscow, Russia. It was almost noon, and Ivanov was still in bed. He claimed he wasn't feeling well, moaned something about the snow and the cold and the gray, depressing Moscow sky. Of course, it had nothing to do with all of the vodka and wine and heavy foods he'd consumed until well past midnight. Shvets would have liked to throw him in a cold snowdrift and shock him back to the here and now. The young Russian didn't understand depression. He couldn't see how people allowed it to get so bad that they couldn't get out of bed, was unable to understand that the drinking and the sleeping were all intertwined like a big sheet wrapped around your body until you couldn't move. And then you started sinking. Stop the drinking, get out of bed and work out. Have a purpose in life. It was not complicated. Shvets crossed from one end of the parlor to the other, glancing at Alexei, who was one half of his boss's favorite bodyguard duo. They were in a corner suite on the top floor of Hotel Baltchug. He looked out the big window across the frozen Moscow River at the Kremlin, Red Square, and St. Basil's Cathedral. Shvets had never understood why the Bolsheviks had let the cathedral stand. They were so anti-Tsar, so anti-religion. Why let this one church remain while they destroyed so many others? The answer probably lay in their own doubts about what they were doing. The people had risen up and helped them grab power, but the people were a tough beast to tame. Shvets thought they probably feared it would bring about another revolution. Frost had built up around the edges of the window. It was -20°C, and the wind was blowing, whipping up clouds of snow, but so what? That was February in Moscow. Only a weak man allows the weather to affect his mood. Shvets let out a long exhalation, his breath forming a fog on the window that froze within seconds. Ivanov was about to drag him down, take him under like some fool walking out under the melting March ice of the Moscow River. These weren't the old days of deportation to a Siberian work camp and executions against the back wall at Lubyanka. But the government was by no means just. The new regime was just more astute at PR. They could still be beaten senseless and be forced to sign false confessions of crimes against the state and whatever else they decided to trump up. Then they would be taken to the woods and shot, far away from the ears of the people and the new press. Ivanov would, of course, try to save his vodka-soaked hide. That was his nature. He would blame anyone but himself, and since Shietz was the person most directly in the line of fire, the only person other than Ivanov who had actually met Herr Dorfman, he would be the scapegoat. Gripped with an unusual fear, Shietz had a sudden urge to flee. He paced from one end of the parlor and back, trying to calm himself, but he couldn't. The idea of running was suddenly in front of him, like a big flashing road sign warning the bridge is out. Turn now or crash. But he had a wife and two boys. Not that he saw them very much, or really loved them, or, more precisely, her. The boys were too young to judge. His wife, on the other hand, had been a mistake. She'd gotten fat and lazy, and Shietz spent as little time with her as possible. He could certainly live without them, but could he live with himself if anything happened to them? He wasn't sure about that one. So he set it aside. Starting over was the other problem. As Ivanov's top deputy, he was poised for lofty heights within the SVR, and like his boss, he could leverage that for personal gain in the not-so-distant future. That was something he did not want to give up without a fight. But the rumors were starting, and by next week, they would be undeniable. He had either to run or turn on Ivanov, go to SVR headquarters, and ask for a face-to-face with Director Primakov. Even as he thought about it, he knew it would be far riskier than running. It was easy to trick himself into thinking they would reward him for doing the right thing. But the SVR was not all that different from the old KGB. You were rewarded for plotting, conspiring, and crushing your political and professional opponents, not for doing the right thing. If he turned on Ivanov in such a manner, he would not be rewarded. He would be punished. Not right away, but eventually. They would send him away. No one would want to look at him because he would be a reminder of their failures. He didn't even consider going to the Federal Counterintelligence Service. The FSK would jump at the chance to embarrass their flashy sister agency, especially if it meant taking down someone as big as Ivanov. But Shvets had no desire to be branded a traitor for the rest of his days. The men who turned against the security service had an extremely high occurrence of suicide. Shvets was pragmatic to the core, but this sitting around could only spell disaster. Some type of action had to be taken. He turned away from the window and looked at Alexei, the thick-necked bodyguard. "Alexei, do you trust me?" The bodyguard lifted his heavy head and looked at Shvets. He shrugged in the way a man shrugs when he finds a question not worth answering. "Do you know what is going on with our boss?" Another shrug. "You know he's in trouble, yes?" This time big Alexei nodded. "He's in a great deal of trouble, and he doesn't want to admit it. He would prefer to drink himself silly and shut himself in with the hope that the problem will simply go away. The problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it is only going to get worse." Shietz was tempted to tell him what was going on, but wasn't prepared to go that far. "I need your help, Alexei. I need to get him out of bed and sober him up enough so that he can defend himself. Do you understand that?"
"Yes."
"Good," Shvets said, satisfied that he had gotten somewhere with the man. "Now don't shoot me or break my neck, but I'm going in there to wake him up." Alexei pursed his big lips while he thought about that one.
"He told me no one, including you.
Your job is to protect him, right? Well, if he put a gun to his own head, would you try to stop him?"
"Yes." "That's what he's doing right now. By getting drunk and sleeping the day away, he's killing himself as surely as if he put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger. You need to help me save him."
"What do you want me to do?"
"Nothing. Just sit here, and don't hurt me.
Fietz didn't wait for an answer. He went to the bedroom door, knocked twice, and then opened. The bed was huge, and with all the pillows and blankets and two prostitutes and poor light, he couldn't tell what was what, so he went to the window and yanked open the heavy velvet drapes. Gray light poured into the room, and Fietz heard Ivanov moan. He searched the tangled mess and still couldn't find the man's head.
"Sir," Fietz announced, "Director Primakov is here to see you."
A flurry of activity erupted from under the blankets. One or both of the girls screamed as Ivanov dug his way out, all elbows and knees. His red face appeared midway down the length of the bed.
"What?"
he asked, a mask of horror on his face.
"You can't be serious."
"No, I am not, but if you don't get out of bed and do something about this situation, he will show up sooner than you think. Or maybe you would prefer Director Baranikov to show up with the FSK boys and drag you downtown."
Ivanov pulled his head back under the covers.
"Go away."
"No, I will not. You have been pouting for 3 days now. We need to come up with a plan of action or we are doomed."
"We are worse than doomed. We are fucked."
"Stop being such a baby."
"Be careful what you say to me, Nikolai, or I will get out of this bed and throw you out the window."
"Not a bad way to go when compared to what the FSK will do to me. Unfortunately, you have neither the strength nor the courage to throw me out the window, so it looks like I will be tortured in the basement of Lubyanka."
He looked over at the bed, but there was no movement or reply.
"Please, boss, I beg you to do something, anything. Defend yourself. Tell Director Primakov the money is gone."
"You are a fool. I will be put under an examination that I won't be able to withstand."
"Then place the blame on the dirty Palestinians. You know how Primakov hates them. Tell him they killed Sharif over a bad business deal and took all of the money. Blame the Americans, the Brits, the French, the Germans. I don't care. Just blame someone and start investigating. What you are doing..."
"What was that?"
Ivanov snapped as he popped his head back out.
"Blame someone and start investigating."
"Before that. At the beginning.
Blame the Arabs."
"You are right. Primakov does hate them. But my money, what about that?"
Fietz was pleased with his small victory. Now he needed to bait the hook.
"I have some ideas about that as well."
He started walking toward the double doors.
"I suggest you get out of bed and shower. I will order an extremely late breakfast. We can discuss your finances over coffee and eggs."
Chapter 52. Beirut, Lebanon. Rapp was in his boxers, pistol at his side, staring at the door of the apartment and trying to decide what to do. It was dark, and he had no idea how long he had slept. Whoever was trying to get into the apartment had picked the lock. Rapp raised the pistol and took aim. Either that or he had a key. He eased his finger off the trigger. Maybe it was a nosy landlady, or Hurley was testing him. No, it wouldn't be that. If they were still in training, it would be something he'd gladly try, but not in the thick of it like this. For all he knew, Rapp might use it as an excuse to shoot him. Rapp stayed in the hallway that led to the bedroom so he could use the wall as cover. The door started to move, and then stopped. The rubber stop he'd placed underneath it was doing its job. The door opened a crack, and Rapp heard someone saying something, whispering as if they were talking to someone else, but then Rapp heard, "Hey, open up," in English. Part of the problem was that he had no idea how long he'd slept and consequently what time it was. He had awakened with a start as he heard some soft knocking on the door, followed by the sound of metal on metal, and now whoever was out there was talking to him and getting louder.
"Hey, shithead, open the damn door, we've got big problems."
The contraction of "we have" was what caught his attention. It was not Hurley or Richard, so the "we" thing threw another level of mystery into the equation.
"I know you're in there. Open this fucking door so I don't have to break it down."
Rapp quietly crossed the room on the balls of his feet. The door was cracked about an inch.
"Who is it?" "Fucking Goldilocks. We've been compromised. Open the door. I need to get you the hell out of here."
Rapp's heart started trotting. Goldilocks. Compromised? What the hell was going on?
"What's the password?"
Rapp heard the word "shit" followed by a heavy sigh.
"I'm not part of your merry little band. I don't know the password."
There was a pause, and then
There's a leather case in the bedroom closet with a few handy things in it. You're probably holding one of the silenced Berettas right now. I'm the guy who put it there.
Rapp frowned. Were you in Istanbul a week ago? There was a pause, and then,
yeah, was that you?
Nice little garden flat with alley access.
Case was in an armoire.
With a pillow and blanket on top, Rapp said.
Bingo.
Let me close the door first, and then I'll let you in.
Roger.
Rapp pushed the door closed and kicked the doorstop out of the way. With his pistol in his right hand, he opened the door and then stepped back, holding the gun in a two-handed grip. The guy entered the room and closed the door behind him. He was wearing brown pants, brown shirt, and brown baseball hat. Where had Rapp seen that outfit before? The visitor dropped the box he was carrying and raised his hands.
Kid, could you lower the gun? If I was a terrorist, I would have blown the damn building up.
Looking over the iron sights of the Beretta, Rapp said, a few more questions. What's going on?
You've been compromised. I was ordered by Washington to come get you.
Who?
Irene.
Rapp lowered the gun.
Why? Follow me,
the man said as he picked up his box and started for the bedroom. Stan and your other buddy were picked up at their hotel this morning.
This morning?
Rapp asked, dumbfounded. What time is it?
Almost 6:30. They were grabbed by the cops and then handed over to those assholes from Islamic Jihad.
Rapp stopped moving. Say that again.
Don't stop moving, kid. They could be on their way here right now, and I don't think we want to be standing around talking when they show up.
He opened the box and pulled out clothes that matched his.
Here, put these on. I'll grab your shit.
He tossed the clothes on the bed and went to the closet, retrieving Rapp's suitcase as well as the beat-up leather case. Rapp's mind was swimming upstream, trying to process what he'd just learned.
But
the man turned on him, a frightened, wild look in his eyes.
No buts, he hissed. No questions, no nothing. We need to get the fuck out of here, and I mean now.
Rapp nodded and began putting on his clothes. This stranger was right, of course. He quickly put on the brown uniform and stuffed his clothes in his suitcase, while the stranger wiped down the doorknobs. In just under 2 minutes, they were out the door and on their way to the street. The stranger went out first, and after casually looking up and down the street, motioned for Rapp to follow. They threw the suitcase and empty box in the back of a simple white minivan, then left. Rapp glanced at his rental car and almost said something, but thought better of it. They had bigger problems. Chapter 53. Mugnia refused to come to Martyr Square, so they had to go to him. Syed could hardly blame him. He couldn't wait for the standoff to end and the hostages to be out of his care. He was tied to them like a mother to her breastfeeding brood. Still, there was something very exciting about the work that lay ahead. Bill Sherman was a once-in-a-lifetime experiment. The American intrigued and horrified him at the same time. Syed had participated in close to 100 interrogations, and he'd never seen anything even close to what he'd witnessed today. The other man, the younger one, was fairly straightforward. A few threats, some punches and kicks, and one fingernail was all it took to get him talking. He'd gotten a name out of him, several actually. It was possible that they were both fake, but he didn't really care at this point. The important thing was that the great and powerful America had once again failed. They had tried to interfere in the affairs of tiny Beirut, and he had beaten them at their game yet again. And this one would hurt. Cummins was one thing, but Bill Sherman would have secrets to tell, secrets that Moscow would have to pay for. They were in the cellar of a bistro on General de Gaulle Boulevard, the west end of town, just a block from the ocean. The Civil War followed the same patterns as any war, but on a much smaller scale. Two blocks either side of the Green Line was virtually destroyed, buildings blown to pieces from high-explosive artillery shells and mortar rounds. Nearly every building had the pockmarks of small arms fire, but beyond the Green Line you could find a street devastated by the war, yet there would be one building untouched. That one would survive, while 6 or 8 in either direction fell, made no sense. But it was an undeniable fact of war that some men and some buildings seemed to have an almost invisible shield around them. Farther away from the Green Line, entire neighborhoods had made it through the war with far better success, losing only a building or two from the random shelling. Mugnia loved these buildings. He noted them and used them for his most important meetings. This restaurant was that kind of lucky building. Syed had been initially irritated by all of the extra security measures. They were brought to 3 different locations and forced to switch cars before they arrived at the bistro. Ognia was the most paranoid of the group by a long shot. They found him in the back room with Badruddin. Plates of hummus, akawi, roasted nuts, kibbeh, baba ganoush, and spiced fish were waiting. After the last few days, Syed could barely contain himself. He dug in, using the flatbread to scoop up the hummus and then some olives and cheese. Mugniya watched with interest as Syed devoured the food, and Radi sat sipping his water. He had heard of the deplorable conditions at Martyr Square. He'd spent the better part of his life living in abject poverty, so it wasn't that he was above slumming it with the men, and he despised the Maronites as much as or more than any of them. It was the American prisoners who kept him away. Those men would attract too much attention. The Americans would be looking for them, and if they got lucky, well, the building would be leveled with everyone in it.
Radi, Mugniya asked, why aren't you eating?
I'm not hungry.
Mugniya could tell there was something else bothering him, but he was extremely unsympathetic to the problems of others. He stabbed out his cigarette and asked,
can we be sure he is the same Bill Sherman who escaped the embassy bombing in 83?
Syed nodded while he washed some baba ganoush down with a glass of water.
It's him. And did you learn anything from him today?
We should kill him, Radi said. He is the devil himself. We should not tempt fate a second time. Give me the word, and I will kill him tonight.
Mugniya had no idea what had precipitated such a drastic statement from a man who loved to barter for the lives of hostages. He turned to Syed.
And what do you think?
Mr. Sherman is an interesting man. A professional liar and provocateur, for certain. But he is also an extremely valuable asset.
The man is a curse on all of us, Radi proclaimed. I am telling you we should rid ourselves of lies and kill him tonight.
Thinking it would be a good idea to change the subject, Syed asked, where is Colonel Jalil?
He will not be joining us.
Mugniya turned and shared a knowing glance with Badruddin. They had been conspiring. That was plain enough to Syed, and if it meant leaving the Iranian out, that was fine with him. Syed watched as Mugniya's mood turned dark. He'd seen it before. And when he was sour like this, he could be prone to violence. Like some 15th-century sultan who could on a whim ask for someone's offensive head to be separated from the rest of his body. No hierarchy had ever been established with the group. But there was nonetheless a natural order to things. Mugniya sat atop the food chain for the simple reason that he was the most ruthless among a group of men who were no strangers to violence. The key, Syed had learned, was to think very carefully before answering him when he was in one of his exceptionally surly moods.
What do you have in mind, Mustafa?
Before he could answer, Radi said for the third time, I think we should kill him. He did not bother to look at the others. His voice was eerily devoid of his normal youthful passion.
I think the man is the shaitan himself. We should take him out to the statue tonight and disembowel him. Leave him to a slow death. He can howl his lies at the moon. Let him be an example to the Americans and anyone else who wants to send their assassins to Beirut.
Syed held his breath. His eyes darted back and forth between the upstart and the lion. Radi was not a deeply religious man, and his proclamation that the prisoner was the devil was likely to give the duo from Islamic Jihad pause. But then again, Mugniya did not like being interrupted.
Asef?
Mugniya asked Syed.
Syed pulled in a quick breath and said, I'm not sure I would go as far as to call the man Satan. But on the other hand, there is undeniably something very wrong with Mr. Bill Sherman.
Glancing at Radi, he added, I can appreciate why Abu might think that would be a good idea, but I'm afraid we would be destroying a very valuable commodity. Mugniya grinned knowingly. They were of the same mind.
Before we decide on something so brash, Badruddin said in his easy tone, we need to assess a few things, such as our finances.
Mugniya held out his hand and said, we will get to that in a second, but first, I want to talk about Sherman. Why is he back after all these years?
Syed straightened up.
He says he is here to kill us, but it is unwise to listen to much of anything that comes out of his mouth.
He glanced at Radi and gave him a reassuring nod. What Sherman had said about the young man's mother did not have to be repeated.
His associate, though, is far more truthful,
and he says they are here to negotiate the release of Agent Cummins. Ruddy was rubbing his swollen knuckles.
I do not believe either of them.
You don't think they are here to negotiate the release of Agent Cummins?
Mugnia asked.
I don't believe anything that comes out of their mouths.
Syed could see Mugnia's legendary temper begin to simmer.
Do you understand the term unintended consequences?
The young leader of Fatah shrugged, as if he couldn't care less.
How about luck, as in good or bad luck?
Ruddy nodded this time.
Well, let me explain to you why your mood is starting to upset me. 6 months ago, you decided to kidnap an American businessman who, as it turns out, is just that. He is not a spy. You kidnapped him without coming to us for approval. For that reason alone, I could have you shot. That single kidnapping has set in motion a series of events. Agent Cummins was then sent to try to negotiate the release of this businessman. You decided to then grab Cummins rather than negotiate a fee and end it. Fortunately or unfortunately, we found out that Mr. Cummins is a CIA spy.
How could that be unfortunate?
Ruddy proclaimed more than asked. Mugnia sat back and gripped the armrests of his chair, almost as if he were trying to hold himself back.
I am in a rather bad mood tonight, so I suggest you keep your interruptions to a minimum, Abu, or I might lose control and snap your scrawny little neck.
He let a moment pass, and when he was sure that he had the younger man's attention, he continued.
Where was I? Yes. As it turned out, Mr. Cummins was not who he said he was. He is, in fact, an American spy. Now, when we are a few days away from handing Cummins over to the Russian, the notorious Bill Sherman and another CIA lackey show up. Are you following me so far?
Ruddy nodded.
All of this was set in motion by one event, your kidnapping of the businessman. These are what we would call unintended consequences. How many more unintended consequences are going to pop up? Are there any more Americans in the city or on their way to the city? Will the four of us survive the week? These are the questions that we will not know the answers to until this thing plays itself out. Your heart is in the right place, and you are eager, but you need to understand that your actions have consequences. Have I made myself clear?
Yes.
Now, the unfortunate thing is that the Americans appear to have learned their lesson after they let us ship their old station chief off to Tehran, so we could thoroughly interrogate him and then dismantle their network of spies. This time, it appears, they are going to try to get one of their own back. The only surprise is that they didn't try to do it sooner. But now that we have the legendary Mr. Sherman, I think the stakes have been raised considerably.
How so?
Ruddy asked, trying not to sound confrontational.
Mr. Sherman is a particularly nasty man who no doubt has many nasty secrets bottled up in his sick little head. The CIA will not want those secrets to get out, so I am afraid they will try to get him back as well.
So, Brother Dean said, picking up the conversation, we must move quickly and carefully to rid ourselves of all these Americans.
And that is where the Russian comes in.
Mugnia stared at Syed.
Asif, when was the last time you heard from the Russian?
Syed wiped the corners of his mouth. Yesterday. I was not able to get hold of him today.
Has he mentioned anything about Dorfman and the empty accounts?
No. Mugnia and Badruddin looked at each other and nodded in agreement. Badruddin spoke.
Don't you find his silence on the subject a bit strange?
I do.
There are three possibilities.
Father Dean held up one finger.
The first, the Russian has no idea our banker was murdered in his home on Sunday, and that the very next morning millions of dollars were emptied out of accounts that he himself helped us set up. Does anyone believe for a second that the Russian is that clueless?
When they were all done agreeing, Badreddin moved on to his second point. The Russian, being the greedy man that he is, killed Dorfman and took all of the money for himself. Mugniya held up two fingers and said, I am going with option two.
What about option three? Syed asked.
Someone unknown to us killed Dorfman and stole the money. The only problem with this theory is that Dorfman was very secretive about his clients. The man had no social skill. He cared only for his dogs. Still, someone, an enemy, could have found out. Syed tried to keep the options open. Let me ask you, Mugniya said, leaning forward, can you think of anyone you know who has a reputation for cheating people out of their money? I don't want to be in the position of defending Ivanov, but I think we need more evidence before we settle on him as the thief.
You didn't answer my question.
Syed nodded. You are correct. Mikhail Ivanov is not exactly the most honest man I know.
And let's not forget the little falling out he had with our Turkish friend,
Badreddin added. Syed was the one who had passed on the information he'd picked up from Damascus. Hamdi Sharif, the arms dealer whom they had worked with for close to a decade, had reportedly had a fight with Ivanov over a business deal. A month later, Sharif ended up assassinated on a park bench in front of his house. He had asked Ivanov about it, but of course the man had denied any connection. Mugniya placed his big, hairy right hand on the table. He tapped a thick finger and said, Moscow is a den of thieves. I warned all of you about this years ago. The collapse has turned it into a free-for-all, where the most brutal simply take what they want.
Syed couldn't argue with what he had said.
So what do we do?
You say the Russian will be here Friday?
Yes.
Good. We are going to have a little auction.
The word seemed to wake up Radi.
What kind of auction?
The kind where we sell the American spies to the highest bidder.
What bidders? Syed asked.
Don't worry, Mugniya cautioned. Just make sure the Russian is here, and I'll take care of the rest.
What about Damascus? I must report this missing money.
Mugniya shook his head.
Not yet. Give me a few days, and then you can tell them.
Chapter 54. Rapp stepped out into the hot afternoon sun and looked over the edge of the veranda. The narrow street that snaked its way up the hill was barely wide enough for a single car to pass. Down at the bottom, maybe 100 yards away, he could see the Toyota pickup truck blocking the street. The houses on this little goat hill were all flat-roofed. Clotheslines were strung up, and shirts and pants and other garments flapped in the breeze. Beneath him, in the tiny courtyard, three vehicles were packed in with no more than a few feet in between. The 10-foot wall had a ring of razor wire strung from one end to the other. He looked to his right and found a stack of green fiberglass crates. Stenciled on the side in black letters were a string of numbers and letters that he didn't understand, then a few that he did. Each crate contained multiple M72 LAW anti-armor weapons. Next to those were a crate of rounds for an M203 grenade launcher that was leaning against the wall. Above that, affixed to the wall, was a hand-drawn laminated map that marked the distance and elevation to certain landmarks up to a mile away. Rapp was wondering what all this stuff was for when he heard the voice of the man who had pulled him out of the safe house the night before.
We call this the skybox, not anymore, really, but during the height of the war, we would sit up here and watch it all unfold.
Rapp turned around to find Rob Ridley sipping on a bright red can of Coke.
Skybox?
Ridley approached the edge of the balcony, pointed toward the ocean to the north, and then drew his hand south.
See that big ugly scar that runs from the north to the south?
Yeah.
That's the famous Green Line. We'd sit up here and watch them fight like a football game. That's why we called it the skybox.
Rapp pointed to the stack of U.S. Army crates.
Looks like you guys did more than watch.
That shit is more for self-defense, although I saw some badass snipers roll through here. That's the unwritten story about this little war, the snipers. They did most of the damage. We found that they were getting a little close. Early pointed up at the overhang. They started sending rounds in here on a daily basis. We put up sandbags, and then, after one of our guys got killed, we put in a request for a couple of those badasses from Fort Bragg. Two of them showed up 5 days later. Ridley pointed at the map on the wall. They put that thing together. In 6 days, they had 31 recorded kills, and that pretty much solved the problem. Kind of like bringing in an exterminator. Ridley laughed and then added, "That's classified, so I don't go around telling that story to just anyone." "How long have we had a presence up here?" "You'd have to ask Stan that question. I was still in the Marine Corps when they blew our barracks up." Ridley pointed to the south. "Right over there. I showed up in 88. That was when we started rotating sniper teams through here. They loved it. In fact, this is where the D-boys battle-tested the first Barrett 50 caliber. He shot a guy just over 7,000 feet away."
"That's more than a mile."
1.3 and some change."
Ridley looked off toward the green line.
"Strange breed, those snipers. Pretty quiet lot. Kept to themselves for the most part, but that night they got shit-faced and naked. I guess 7,000 feet is a pretty rare club. At any rate, I think we've been up here since 85.
"I thought we pulled out," Rapp said.
"Langley never pulls out, or at least rarely. Shit, this little outpost is what stopped this thing from being a complete disaster. We knew everything Damascus was up to. We helped blow up supply convoys, target the occasional asshole who wandered too far away from his home turf. We even taught these guys how to use indirect fire, and the other side knew we were here, too. That's why they sent those snipers after us."
"So this is where you're based?" Rapp asked, thinking it didn't make a lot of sense.
"No," Ridley shook his head, "not for over a year. Things are too quiet around here now."
"So what exactly do you do for Langley?"
"I'm kind of here and there. I guess you could call me a floater."
Rapp had no idea what that meant, and got the distinct impression that Ridley wasn't going to enlighten him any further. Rapp let out a yawn. His nights and days were upside down. After their mad dash from the apartment, Ridley had filled in some of the blanks. The problem was that beyond the obvious fact that Hurley and Richard had been picked up, Ridley had very few details. Rapp had pressed him hard, wanting to know what Langley was doing to find them. Ridley had to admit not much of anything. Langley was sending a small 6-man SOG team, and they were actively trying to collect any intel that would aid in a rescue. Ridley worked his sources well past midnight, but every single one of them seemed to have conflicting information. Finally, at 4 a.m., he sent Rapp to bed and told him to get some rest. He assured Rapp he'd been through more than a few of these abductions, and they'd tended to progress slowly, especially for the first few days. Rapp had a hard time falling asleep. He couldn't stop himself from imagining what Hurley and Richards were going through. As part of his training, he'd spent 2 days tied to a chair. Guys would come in randomly and smack him around. They even gave him some low-voltage shocks from a small engine battery. There was nothing remotely enjoyable about the experience. And Hurley had cautioned them that it paled in comparison to what they would go through at the hands of a sadist or a skilled interrogator. Finally, around sunrise, he had dozed off.
"Listen, I know what you're going through."
Rapp gave him a sideways glance. Ridley was a few inches shorter and a decade or so older. Rapp couldn't quite figure out if he was an optimist or a pessimist. He seemed to kind of float back and forth between the two.
"I've known Stan for 6 years. I'd do anything to try to save the guy. But we need to get some good intel before we can even consider lifting a finger."
Back in training, if someone had asked him to lay down his life to save Stan Hurley, he would have laughed at him. But now he wasn't so sure. "Any idea where they are?"
Ridley pointed east. "The other side of the big ugly scar. Indian country."
"You ever go over there?"
Ridley gave him a nervous laugh. "I try not to."
"So you've been?"
"Occasionally. It's nowhere near as bad as it was back when the shit was really flying."
He searched Rapp's face, wondering what he was thinking.
"It's still a nasty place for a stranger like you, kid."
Rapp nodded, even though he really wasn't listening. "So it wouldn't be such a good idea to wander over there and start asking questions."
"That would be about the dumbest thing you could do, kid."
Ridley could see the upstart wasn't listening to him. He reached out and grabbed his arm.
I've been to that little lake house down in southern Virginia. I've seen the way Stan takes badasses and grinds them up and spits out little pussies, so I'm guessing if you made it through his selection process, you've got some serious skills, am I right?
Rapp looked at Ridley's grip until he released his arm. What's your point?
I don't care how good you are. Going over to Indian country on your own is a suicide mission. We'll end up looking for three of you instead of two.
Well, I'm not good at sitting around, so somebody better come up with a plan, and come up with it quick.
The triple beep-beep-beep of a car horn caught their attention, and they both looked to the base of the hill, where a three-car convoy had just pulled up to the roadblock.
Finally, Ridley said.
Who is it?
A local who knows more about this hellhole than anyone.
Chapter 55. Moscow, Russia. Sietz anxiously checked his watch. They'd been in there for more than an hour, and each passing tick of the clock only added to his apprehension. For starters, he didn't like sitting in the waiting room of Director Primakov's office on the top floor of SVR headquarters. Any trip to these lofty heights would test a man's nerves, but considering the events of the past few days, Sietz worried that he might be leaving the building in shackles. He doubted that Primakov knew about the missing money or the other mistakes that were piling up. The SVR was an entrenched organization with thousands of operations, and Ivanov was regarded as a daring man who knew when to be ruthless and when to smile. And in the years between Stalin's violent mood swings and the collapse of the CCCP, that would have been more than enough. Now he wasn't sure. This was a brave new world. The money grab was in full swing. Oligarchs were popping up and riding the wave of decentralization, but not without problems. The peasants were growing dissatisfied with what they saw as unbridled greed and corruption. And the one thing every Muscovite feared, more than even a tyrant like Stalin, was the rage of the mob. The mob was like some ancient god who needed regular sacrifices. The men in charge knew that, and in order to satisfy that mob and keep it from bubbling over into the streets, they would look for a few bodies to throw them. One or two public executions would go a long way toward calming the hordes. It was Sviet's plan. After he'd forced some real food into Ivanov's gullet the previous afternoon, he began to sketch out their strategy. It would be centered on Primakov's distrust of Islamic Jihad and its sister organizations. The missing funds would be laid at their feet, along with the assassination of the banker. As Ivanov's devious brain began to work, he hit upon the idea of blaming them for Hamdi Sharif's murder as well. Sviets wasn't so sure. He was from the new generation. Ivanov was from the old, whose motto was, "If you are going to lie, lie big." The tricky part was this agent they were offering up. They had confirmed through one of their sources inside the CIA that Mark Cummins did in fact exist and that he had worked in Moscow before being stationed in Damascus. If Ivanov could deliver someone like that, Primakov might be willing to forget the missing funds. The only problem was coming up with the money to pay off the Palestinians. Ivanov would have to convince Primakov to give him the funds necessary to complete the transaction. And then this morning Syed called, and things became infinitely more interesting. He explained that he was now in possession of two more Americans who had been sent to try to buy the release of Agent Cummins. One of the men was nothing more than an underling, but the other was the catch of a lifetime. When pressed, Syed refused to give details, saying he would only discuss the matter in person when they arrived in Beirut. Still, there was no mention of Dorfman and the missing money. Syed's continued silence over the missing funds had caused Ivanov to rethink the issue. What if Islamic Jihad and Fatah no longer feared him? What if they thought Russia too disorganized to care? There had been plenty of heated feuds between the various Palestinian factions over the years, and Syed was the man who had profited the most by peddling arms to all sides. What if that thug Mugnia had decided to take what he wanted? Kill Dorfman, take all the money, solidify his position, and thumb his nose at Ivanov. That thought had caused Ivanov to reach for the vodka, but Sviets had stopped him. He was scheduled to meet with Primakov in less than an hour, and he needed to be sober. The problem had become clear to Sviets as well. Why else would Syed stay quiet over the missing funds? If his money was gone as well, he would be demanding answers. The only logical reason for his silence
was that they had taken the money, and they were daring Ivanov to bring it up. Ivanov had to assume they had every last shred of damning information that Dorfman had kept, all of the various accounts and how Ivanov had bilked his own government out of millions on the arms shipments by playing the middleman with Syed. That information alone could sink him. Ivanov's hands were tied, at least for now. That was how Svets had counseled him. Go along with this ruse. Go to Beirut and look the liars in their eyes, and then ask them where the money had gone. Bring a show of force that will make them think twice about stealing from you. Ivanov liked the idea. As he walked into Primakov's office, he turned and told Svets to wait outside. Svets knew his boss too well to think he was anything other than a duplicitous snake. As he nervously checked his watch, the minutes ticking by, he figured out what Ivanov was up to. He was in there right now, blaming him for the missing funds. He'd probably already ordered someone to begin creating a false trail between him and Dorfman. That way, when it really did blow up, Ivanov could step back and blame his inept deputy, Svets. Svets didn't know if he was more upset with Ivanov or with himself for not seeing it sooner. He should have left him in bed and gone to Primakov and taken his chances. When the door finally opened, Ivanov appeared with a stoic look on his face. He never broke stride as he headed for the elevator. As he walked past his deputy, he snapped his fingers for him to follow. Svets hopped to his feet and buttoned his jacket, hustling to catch up. Once in the elevator, Svets asked, "Well?"
"It was good. He understands what must be done."
Svets started to ask another question, but Ivanov shook his head in a very curt way that told him this was not the place to talk. When they entered Ivanov's office less than a minute later, the director of Directorate S went straight for the vodka. Svets did not try to stop him this time. It was approaching mid-afternoon, and he took it as a victory that he'd kept him sober this long. He waited for his boss to consume a few ounces. When Ivanov looked relaxed enough, Svets asked,
"What did he say?"
Ivanov yanked at his tie.
"He sees things our way. He knows the true character of those Palestinian carpet monkeys."
Svets was used to his boss uttering racist slurs, so he paid them little attention. He also knew that his boss was paranoid enough in general, but especially today. He was worried his office was bugged.
"So what is the plan?"
"We leave in the morning."
"Alone?" Svets asked, honestly scared.
"No." Ivanov had a huge grin. "The director has been quite generous. He is sending along some Spetsnaz, one of the crack Vimpel units."
Svets wasn't sure if that was good or bad news. The Vimpel units specialized in assassination and sabotage, among other things.
"Why a Vimpel unit?"
"Because he's sending us with cash."
"How much?"
Ivanov smiled and held up five fingers.
"Really?"
Svets's surprise was evident on his face.
"Don't be so shocked. I have no doubt it will be counterfeit, probably being printed as we speak."
Svets had heard rumors about the old KGB printing presses that could turn out francs, Deutsche Marks, pounds, and dollars on demand.
"Will they be able to tell?"
"If the Americans can't tell, how will the Palestinians be able to tell?"
Svets wasn't so sure, but he went along with it.
"Don't look so nervous."
Ivanov came over and put an arm around Svets's shoulders.
"I told him how useful you have been to me. I have no doubt that when we return with these mystery Americans, you will be given a nice promotion."
Svets smiled, even though he didn't feel like it. The truth was, there was probably a better-than-even chance that he'd be given a dirty, dank cell. Chapter 56. Beirut, Lebanon. According to Ridley, it was very poor spycraft to meet a source at a safe house, but for this particular source they made exceptions. The reason was fairly straightforward. The source owned the house. Levon Petrosyan had the complexion of someone who was born further north, but had lived long enough in the sun-baked city that his skin was deeply lined and had taken on the appearance of a permanent sunburn. His white hair had receded almost to the midpoint of his head, and he was a good 50 pounds overweight. He entered the house out of breath, a cigarette dangling from his lips, his four bodyguards moving in tandem, two in front and two behind. The bodyguards were young, big, and fit. Two looked like locals, and two had Petrosian's northern complexion. Petrosian walked over to Ridley, grabbed him by the shoulders, and kissed the American on both cheeks. And then, refusing to let go, he stared into Ridley's eyes and spoke to him. His face didn't so much as twitch, his eyes didn't blink, only his lips moved. After the intense one-sided exchange, the Armenian gave Ridley one more hug, and then his eyes lifted and settled on Rapp. He released Ridley and asked, "Is this the one?" Ridley nodded. Petrosian sized Rapp up and then announced, "I must shake your hand." The man spoke perfect English, but with one of those clipped heavy Russian accents. Rapp couldn't come up with a single good reason why this man would want to shake his hand, but he stuck his right hand out as a polite reflex. In a voice only the two of them could hear, he said, "I have hated that Turkish pig, Hamdi Sharif, for almost 20 years. I want to thank you for putting a bullet in his black heart. When I heard he was dead, I wept tears of joy." Rapp's own heart began to beat a little faster. How in hell did this man know he had killed Sharif? Rapp tilted his head to the left so he could get a good look at Ridley. The man shrugged his shoulders as if to say he was sorry. So much for secrecy. "I am very sorry about Bill." Rapp had to remind himself that to these people Stan Hurley was Bill Sherman. "Thank you. Have you found any information that may help us?" He winced, as if disappointed in himself.
"I'm not sure if it will help, but maybe. I confirmed that it was the police that picked our friend up in front of this hotel this morning. In fact, it was the police chief, that pig, Kabir Haddad."
"Haddad is not a bad man," Ridley said for Rapp's benefit, "just extremely corrupt. He works with us sometimes."
"He works with anyone if they have enough money," Petrosian said.
"Levon, anything to drink?"
"No, thank you. My stomach is upset today."
"So this Haddad," Rapp said, "who gave him the order?"
"I am fairly certain it was your friends from Islamic Jihad, but I will know more later. I'm having dinner with Haddad this evening."
"His idea or yours?" Ridley asked.
"His. He's afraid he has offended me, which he has, of course. He knows he cannot simply come into my neighborhood and grab my friends. It would have been nice if you had told me Bill was coming. All of this could have been avoided."
"I know. I already told you I was sorry. He was planning on seeing you today. He didn't want word getting out that he was back."
"And how did that work out for him?"
"I know, but just be careful with Haddad. We can't afford to lose you."
"I am always careful. It will be at a restaurant of my choosing, and I will make sure the street is blocked off. Trust me, he's the one who needs to be nervous."
"That's what worries me. What if he's desperate?"
"He has always been a desperate little man. He knows what he did this morning was wrong. He will be full of fear, and I will play on that fear to get every last piece of information from him."
"Any idea where they took him?" Rapp asked.
"That is the question, isn't it? Where did they take him?"
Petrosian shuffled across the stone floor and out onto the veranda.
"Beirut is not a small city. It is not like your New York or Chicago, but it is not small. Have you figured out how they found him?"
"No," Ridley said. "He flew in last night, shortly after 9. That's all we know."
"I have talked to the people at the hotel, and I am satisfied that they did not know who he was. Somebody must have spotted him at the airport, from the old days. He made a big enough impression in certain circles, and those little Palestinian rats do all the dirty work at the airport. Baggage and fueling, cleaning the planes and the terminal, they treat it like their own little syndicate,"
Petrosian said with contempt.
"I have heard rumors that some of the cab drivers are involved in a kidnapping ring."
"Would they have any pull with Haddad?"
Ridley asked, thinking of the police chief.
"No,"
Petrosian answered as he flicked a long ash over the edge and onto the cars below.
"That would have to be someone much higher up. My guess is the same people who grabbed your other man, the Schnoz. Isn't that what you call him?"
"Yes, you mean Islamic Jihad?"
"Correct. With the help of a few others."
"Anything else?"
"Little things here and there."
Petrosian paused and chewed on his lip for a moment.
"Have you heard about this standoff at Martin Square?"
"I heard a little something yesterday, but not much."
"It is a funny thing,"
Petrosian said, while looking off into the distance.
"What are you talking about?"
Rapp asked. Ridley pointed to the north.
"Follow the scar to the sea. One block short, you can see an open area. That's Martyrs Square."
Before the war it was a beautiful place, full of life, Petrosyan said in a sad voice.
It was the scene of some of the heaviest fighting during the war, Ridley added. The buildings are all empty shells now.
Now that the ceasefire has held, certain groups have gotten the idea that it is time to grab land while they still can. The Maronites started earlier in the week, and they began occupying the buildings along the east side of the square. The Muslims got word and started moving their people into a building on the west side.
Rapp looked at the spit of land. He guessed it was around 2 miles away. Does that mean a fight is brewing?
Part of me wishes they would all just kill each other so the rest of us can pick up the pieces and get back to where we were before this mess started. But I know that this is not the answer. We need the peace to hold.
And how does this Martyrs Square situation figure into our other problems?
It might not, but then again, manpower is an issue.
Manpower? Rapp asked, not understanding.
These groups are like any organization. They have limited resources. They have to collect garbage, collect taxes, man their roadblocks, punish those who aren't behaving. The list goes on and on. The point is, if they are forced to hold the west end of Martyrs Square, they will be weak in other places.
Rapp wondered how he could use that to his advantage. As the sun moved across the afternoon sky, he got the sinking feeling that they were losing an opportunity, that if they didn't act, didn't do something bold and do it soon, Richards and Hurley would share the same fate of Bill Buckley.
Chapter 57. Hurley had lost track of time. After the fingernail incident, they'd left him alone, turned off the light and shut the door. He sat in the chair, his arms duct-taped to the armrests and his ankles to the two front legs. His chest and shoulders were also taped to the chair back, big loops of silver tape as if he were a mummy. For the first few hours he tried to catalog everything he'd seen, said, and heard. Abu Radi was what he'd expected, a thin-skinned, overwrought child in a man's body. If he was lucky, he could provoke the man into killing him. That was the first priority. He had to enrage the man to the point where he defied the orders of the others. Go down fighting. He dozed off, thinking of his own death. What a beautiful death it would be if he could pull it off. Exercise his will over a free man. Inflict enough mental pain on Radi to get him to do something he himself knew was wrong. The thought brought a smile to his swollen lips, and then he let his chin rest on his chest and went to sleep. He awoke some time later. It could have been an hour, 3 hours, or half a day, and what did it really matter? The stink in the room was horrendous, but it was far better than the hood. He needed to go to the bathroom, so he whizzed right there, letting it splash over the seat of the chair onto the concrete floor. That helped him relax a little bit, but his fingers were starting to really sting, so he started talking to God to take his mind off the pain. Hurley had no illusions about his potential for sainthood. He pretty much knew where he was headed when it was over, and yes, he did believe in the man upstairs and the man downstairs. He'd seen too much nasty shit in his life to think for a second that there wasn't both good and evil in this world. Where he fit into that paradigm was a little more complicated. One of his favorite aphorisms involved sending Boy Scouts after bad men. Good people needed men like Hurley, even if they couldn't bring themselves to admit it. Maybe God would take pity on him. Maybe he wouldn't. Hurley bowed his head and asked for forgiveness for any of the innocent people he'd killed over the years. But that was as far as he was willing to go. The assholes he would not apologize for. He then nodded off to sleep again. He awoke later to the sounds of a man screaming. He knew instantly that it was Richards. What they were doing to him, Hurley could only imagine. The screams came and went, rising and falling like waves crashing into the rocks. And then Hurley could tell by the steady rhythm what they were doing. They were electrocuting him, and they weren't bothering to ask questions. They were just trying to wear him down. Listening to the pain of one of his own men was the most difficult thing of all. Hurley bowed his head again and asked God for the strength to kill these men. It went like this for 4 or 5 cycles.
He tried not to obsess over the time. When he was awake, he tried to prepare himself for what would come next, with an almost endless string of awful possibilities. There was one in particular that had him worried. And when the door finally opened, it was as if his captors